Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Independence Day Knockreiner.
Yeah.
Happy for the long weekend.
Happy America Day.
Oh, actually, I guess you might have already enjoyed it by now. I hope you had fun.
On this week's episode, we cover a few different news stories, including a rare out-of-band patch for Microsoft, some research into cryptocurrency wallet phishing campaigns, and research from Malwarebytes on an interesting way that payment card skimming malware is hiding itself from analysts and detection tools. So with that, let's go ahead and skip on in.
I love it. Are we doing a normal skip, or are we doing like the Wizard of Oz type of double skip?
I'll let you use whatever skip you feel like. Last Tuesday, Microsoft quietly pushed out a out-of-band security update that solved two pretty serious-looking vulnerabilities, specifically in how the Windows Codecs library handles compression and decoding large media files like photos and videos. There haven't been any technical details released yet, but it boiled down to a pair of vulnerabilities, CVE-2020-1457 and 1425. That appear to work as a pair to defeat memory protections like ASLR and enable code execution. So we've talked about, I think it was just 2 weeks ago, we talked about ASLR, address space layout randomization.
And DEP and EMID and all the other memory protections that you can enable with Windows.
Yep. If you happen to miss last week or 2 weeks ago's podcast though, basically ASLR, man, I need to fix my notes here on acronyms. That's one thing about this dang industry is everything's an acronym. But anyways, it basically randomizes the base memory location for applications and libraries when they're executed. So part of gaining remote code execution by exploiting like a buffer overflow or a stack overflow or something along those lines is you have to be able to locate objects within the original application's code called gadgets. That basically let you piece together your own little malicious actions and eventually escape outside the application and do whatever the heck you want. And ASLR makes that really difficult to locate those gadgets without identifying where that application is in memory on the system. So generally, when you get a code execution vulnerability, in order to actually exploit it, or I guess when you get a overflow vulnerability, in order to actually exploit it, you also typically need some form of like memory location leak to go along with it as well. And so CVE-2020-1425's description says it's a remote code execution vulnerability exists in the way that Microsoft Windows Codecs library handles objects in memory. An attacker who successfully exploited this vulnerability could obtain information to further compromise a user's system. This is basically the telltale sign of a memory location leak that goes along with code execution. The CVE that ends in 1457 is basically the exact same in terms of the description, except saying that successfully exploiting it enables execution of arbitrary code. So these vulnerabilities were originally reported to Microsoft by a researcher from Trend Micro's Zero Day Initiative, which from a like an analyst standpoint is good because it means we will most likely get details on them sometime soon. I imagine they're just writing up their disclosure, but Trend Zero Day Initiative tends to be pretty good about giving details.
By the way, Trend Micro is also a WatchGuard partner and happens to be where we get IPS signatures. So good chance we'll have signatures for this quickly.
Yep. Now it also, these updates were kind of pushed silently and actually not even through the Windows update mechanism. They're found in both Windows 10 and Windows Server 2019, but the updates for them actually come through the Microsoft Store, interestingly enough, not the normal Windows update mechanism, which is a first for me out of recent memory. Like normally these, I guess the Codecs library management system is through the store and not through the operating system. But I thought that was interesting.
So I didn't pay any attention to that, but there was at least an out-of-cycle bulletin for this, right? And
yep.
I mean, right away, just so the listeners know, it's unusual for Microsoft to do out-of-cycle now. It's not bad when they do. In fact, it's usually good for a good reason. But you know, they are pretty consistent with their second Tuesday of every month patch cycle. And because it's every month, for the most part, you know, they shouldn't need to patch that regularly at a cycle. But when they do, to me, that's a highlight that this is a big deal. This vulnerability is, they expect it to be exploited heavily, or it can easily be exploited heavily. Or worst case, if it wasn't trend finding it, it might be exploited heavily. So I just want to point out that anytime you see an out of cycle Microsoft patch, there's a good chance you should jump on it really quickly.
Yep. You mentioned that it's pretty rare, but normally when they do one of these out of band patches, it generally means that they've found evidence, or someone has found evidence, that it's actively being exploited out in the wild. But Microsoft, during their update, did note that they don't see any evidence in this case of it being exploited in the wild. So I'm assuming that this out of band update is simply because it was probably a very serious vulnerability that if someone were to identify in the next 3 weeks before the next patch, it could be bad news bears, basically.
And by the way, now that the fact that they exist is out, you know, it does show threat actors where to look, in a sense.
Exactly.
I will say the other thing, you know, I like to talk about in this particular one is, you know, if you're not a super security nerd and you don't really care about the technicalities of memory corruption exploitation, the other thing of note here is how the vulnerability is exploited. I mean, at this point, your users are pretty used to executables being bad. And hopefully, by listening to us, seeing our report, they're starting to get used to the fact that documents can be bad, you know. And I sometimes worry about document vulnerabilities, because when we're not talking to you guys, our security professional listeners, but normal people, a lot of normal people think a document can be benign. But what I'm getting to is these issues can be triggered. I believe in testing they were triggered with images, but they can also be triggered by video. And I still think even a lot of technical folks don't really think of images or video triggering exploits of this nature. But it's not new. It's happened for quite a long time. There's been in QuickTime parsers, VLC parsers, Windows Media Player parsers. But I really find anytime it's an image or a video that triggers a vulnerability, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, if you think, especially for, you know, a video is kind of unique and interesting, but the images can be encountered anywhere. A web download, an email, and people never even think about the images that are loading in the background. So just the nature that this is triggered by a specially crafted image is something that makes it pretty significant, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you mentioned like videos too. There was an issue a few years back with StageFright and Android, where it was basically the receiving parser for video files that you receive via text. It would go and pre-parse the video before you even open the text message, and it would trigger this vulnerability that could gain code execution on an Android phone then too. It's like all they had to do was send you a malicious text. You didn't even have to do any, it was a zero-click exploit, and it could take over your phone. So some of these like non-traditional ways of gaining code execution can be pretty serious on whatever system they are.
And it really has to do with the file, like what a user thinks of the safety of a file type. Like I presume most of our listeners realize this issue, but I would suggest that a lot of normal employees just, you know, they might weigh executables as potentially bad highly. They might now weigh documents as a little higher. But if they don't think twice about images or videos, this might be an opportunity to let them know that these exploits can hide in many things, depending on the vulnerability.
The good news is, so these should have been patched automatically on affected systems. You can manually go check. Basically, you just have to open up the Microsoft Store and see if there's any updates. But it's because it isn't even going through the normal update channel, it should have just been quick and silent to fix this flaw. And it's good that they're jumping on it right now. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Trend puts out in their detailed report, because I imagine it's pretty interesting how they managed to piece these two vulnerabilities together to gain code execution. And I don't know, in my opinion, code execution vulnerabilities are always a little bit exciting too.
I'm with you. They're always more interesting.
So moving on to our next story. This one, actually, I stumbled across this one in the Ethereum cryptocurrency subreddit on Reddit the other day. Where it popped up from this researcher called Harry Denley, who published a blog post on Medium detailing his interactions with a cryptocurrency phishing campaign that he found on the Google Play Store. So there's a really popular cryptocurrency wallet that's available on the Google Play Store. It has over 1 million downloads. It's called Trust, and it supports not just Ethereum, but several other cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and stuff, basically as a wallet slash crypto exchange. It was developed by a company called 6Days LLC. Well, Denley, during his research, found a fake version of this wallet, also available on the Google Play Store, that copied the original wallet's listing entirely. Like, the two pages looked identical, except for a few minor changes. So the company name and the bogus one was 6Days LTD instead of LLC. And then the application namespace was com.trust.manager.app instead of com.wallet.crypto.trustapp. So Android apps, just so you're aware, they follow a Java namespace scheme where every single app has to have a unique namespace like this. Usually starts with com, then the company name, then like the app or whatever. You can see it if you open up the Play Store in like your web browser, but it's kind of hidden in the mobile version of it. But anyways, so this attacker basically copied the look of the Trust app, the listing, posted it up there. At the time of the blog post that the researcher put out, it had like 600 something reviews on it and quite a few downloads. But the app itself was really simple. So first up, it loaded up trustapp.ltd in a web view. So a web view in an Android app is basically just loading up a website within the app itself, and it treats it as if it were a page on the app. The page that it loads up prompts the user to enter their mnemonic phrase. So with cryptocurrency wallets, really they're just a public and private key pair, like cryptographic keys. And if you were to try and import a key into a new wallet or a new phone, it would be a bit of a pain in the butt to try and enter in your private key manually. Some apps use like a QR code in order to import it. But if you can't like take a picture of a QR code, instead, a lot of wallets use something called a mnemonic phrase of really 12 to 24 words. And those words act as a seed to generate a key pair, so that if you enter in that same phrase in a different wallet, it'll generate the same exact keys. And that acts as like a recovery mechanism, so that, let's say you lose your phone, if you have that phrase saved somewhere, like in your password manager, or printed off and stored in a bank safe deposit box, you can enter it back into the new wallet and basically recover your keys. But it also means that you have to protect them, because if an attacker is able to get a hold of that mnemonic phrase, they can clone your keys and then use that to steal all of your cryptocurrency, basically. So Denley found that after you entered in the mnemonic phrase on this web view page, the page sent it to a server-side script called process login.php, so basic PHP script, and then it would display a generic something went wrong error message back to the client. And that was basically the whole app. So you open up the app, it asks you for your mnemonic phrase, says something went wrong, which tends to cause people to enter in the same mnemonic phrase again and again, which is beneficial to the attacker. But on the back end,
by the way, I this reminds me, I think I told you this story in the past. One of my first personal hacks, again, I'm pop old man Corey, so this may not speak to all our younger audience, but back when I was in a high school computer class, it was all DOS days, and our computer science teacher had this little app, DOS application, which was that everyone ran and logged into with our student ID to our work. And I created a simple batch script for the DOS people out there. It still works in Windows, by the way, but very few people use batch scripts nowadays. I mean, Windows and DOS, the order, if you have programname.exe versus programname.bat, if you just type the program name without an extension, it will run the batch script first. And my first simple hack was to create a batch script that emulated the student ID login prompt, ask them to enter their ID and credential, give them an error that it didn't work while I keylogged it, and then ran the actual executable that went through the normal login process. This sounds almost identical to that, where, like you say, I guess but they're essentially logging that via their backend server as soon as you enter the new mnemonic key.
So Corey, how's all your new cryptocurrency reserves treating you?
I didn't do it, but it's just, it cracks me up that simple fake do a login, give them a fake error, and then push to the real login page is still like 101 phishing to this day.
Yep. So on the back end, once the server received that mnemonic phrase, it relayed everything to Telegram's API using an API key. So Telegram's a messaging service. Denley found that the attackers like made quite a few mistakes in this whole setup. Yes, it was a pretty convincing fish, and they appear to have done quite well for themselves, as we will probably get to. But they made a lot of mistakes in their own infrastructure. Like, for example, this web server that was loaded up in this web view was misconfigured, and it was exposing the error logs for their Apache web server. And then also they used an incorrect function on their server-side code, which doesn't properly handle errors. So Denley was first able to flood the server with requests, which then flooded that Telegram API and turned on rate limiting. So Telegram started sending back HTTP 429 errors, which then caused the logged the unhandled errors, and then it caused unhandled errors to happen, which were then logged in the error file, which he was then able to view. And long story short, that error file then contained the bot API keys. So with those keys, he was able to denial of service their API endpoint specifically, which while he was doing that, then he was able to view the attacker's own communications. So he could see this group chatting with each other, talking about which wallets they were taking over manually. So it looked like a manual thing and not an automated process, as you might expect. And then meanwhile, he set up his own bot to periodically fetch that Apache error log, find the mnemonic phrases that the victims were entering, and then use those to drain the victims' accounts himself, but hold the funds safe. And then he went to try and find the owners of the original wallets, have them confirm ownership by signing something with their private key, and then return the funds. So basically, he was denial of servicing the infrastructure for this attacker because of a bunch of misconfigurations, and then intercepting the mnemonic phrases and using them to steal the money and give them to the right people.
Because he got the API key, wasn't he even got access to kind of the bot command and control channel to the point where he could actually see their communications, which was interesting, right?
Yeah. So the attackers did end up noticing him, though. They did appear to change their API keys. They also fixed the bug that was exposing that error log for Apache. But he's still basically flooding that server to create noise to try and buy time for victims until Google takes down the app. Because at the time where he posted this article, the app was still available in the Google Play marketplace. So I'm assuming he reported it to Google, but they're taking a little bit of time to take it down. So this was interesting. Like, I went back through some of his other research, and he's done a whole lot of research into phishing and cryptocurrency wallets and fake wallets. And he noted that previously most of the wallets are sideloaded ones. So they're hosted up on a fake or a bogus site. Maybe they're using Google poisoning search results to bump them up in the listings to get people who are looking for a wallet to then sideload the incorrect one. But this one was on the Google Play Store for a decent amount of time. And we've talked about it a few times, how like you can argue whether Google or Apple is more secure, but it does seem, at least in my opinion, that quite a few more things slip through the cracks in Google's Play Store and stick around for a bit of time. Mostly because I think all of theirs is automated, all of their validation, whereas Apple has a lot more hands-on when it comes to validating apps. Would you agree?
Yeah, I that's how it sounds for the validation. I also think, and this is actually, you know, it's a pro and a con for Google. I think they just take a much more open development attitude, allowing developers to have access to anything on an Android system. They don't really, like, there's not a lot on the Android kernel system that's really locked down to developers, which on the positive side, you know, really things like custom VPN apps existed for Android long before iOS. You know, anyone that's had to develop for Apple knows that often they really lock even developers of apps out of certain subsystems on the iOS device.
Like, which, VPNs, for example.
Yeah, it's a little bit more opened up now. They've finally given mechanisms for third parties to do it better, but it took a long time. And there are obvious security advantages to that. The side effect, though, is, you know, it's a less open ecosystem. So it took a lot longer for me. Half the reason I jailbroke my iOS devices 5 years ago is there's a lot of functionality I wanted that you could get on Android first. So it's kind of a pros and a cons thing. I really, to philosophically, like Google's open development attitude. On the flip side, the more you can lock down the system, the easier it is to secure. So it's hard to say. There's going to be vulnerable apps in both app stores, but if you looked at it statistically, I do feel like because of the kind of good guy open development ecosystem, you see more on the Play Store more often. But they're always improving it. I will say, by the way, less technical, but if you're interested, when this particular researcher was intercepting with webhooks some of the communications, he found out that the nickname these guys gave their own phishing campaign was George, but despite that name, they were speaking Turkish to each other. And then some of the translated stuff, the messages he received from these users were talking that, you know, you could see them, oh, I just got 4K from one wallet, 4,000 K, I presume, of US dollars. Another one said 900, another said 5,000. So, you know, as simple as this scheme was, it seemed to be making some hits. And as you mentioned, if it lived on the Amazon store, this seems like it's just a screenshot of messages in a couple hours of monitoring. So imagine how much it got over a significant period of time.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, like, I don't know, it's interesting how long it was able to stay up on the Google Play Store. But it's also like, most of the times when you see these types of phishing attacks, whether it be like a banking app or a cryptocurrency wallet, they tend to automate the process where they'll have it set up where as soon as your mnemonic phrase or your password or whatever gets sent off to their server, they've got something on the back end that will go and drain out the funds out of your account as quickly as possible. But it seemed like these guys were just doing it manually and then like high-fiving each other for everyone they successfully got.
Yep.
It's good news. It's good news that they were doing it manually because it means that he was able to go in there and at least for a bit scrape it out before they could get their hands on it.
Yeah, and if you look at his little Twitter interaction with one of the victims, you know, the whole post about this starts with some poor guy talking about how he just lost 10,000 K from his wallet, his Trust Wallet app. But it'd be so nice on Twitter to get a reply to that. Here's about 4,000 to 5,000 back. So
yeah,
kind of good guy security researcher.
There's been a few cases of this, like with Ethereum specifically. There was a pretty serious vulnerability that someone exploited. Someone was doing it manually, and this other group went in and did it all automatically to hold the money safe for everyone. So it's not the first time it's happened with cryptocurrency. I know with Ethereum specifically, just because of how complex the transactions are, it's actually pretty common for these, like for vulnerabilities in the, I don't want to say the blockchain, but the transactions themselves to enable people to drain money. So it's good that they are receiving researcher insight and looks from researchers into them too. So when it comes to like banking and cryptocurrency apps, I will say like be extra vigilant when installing a new one. In this case, the legitimate app had 1 million downloads and like 30 or over 50,000 reviews, while the malicious one was only a few days old and only had 600 reviews. It's easy for an attacker to seed fictitious reviews in their app, but these all do still tend to be pretty short-lived. So if all the reviews are only from a few days ago, that's a sign that it might not be the correct app. Also, if it's a really good, highly rated, or at least really popular wallet, and it only has a couple thousand downloads, that's another sign that it's probably not the legitimate app. So, like, be extra careful when it comes to installing financial-related apps on your phone. I know in a lot of cases, like, the companies will link to their app directly from their website. That might be a safe way to click to it, to the true app store, and then get the actual legitimate app instead of just searching for it. But, yeah, I don't know. Be safe out there when it comes to cryptocurrency, because it still feels like it's the wild, wild west. And then, finally up for this week was some research from Malwarebytes, where last week they published a blog post on some payment card skimming malware campaign that they've been tracking for quite some time. And their posts are highlighted, though, a really, in my opinion, interesting evasion method that this latest variant has been using. So they started their investigation into this when they noticed a blocked connection to a malicious domain from a WordPress site that was using the WooCommerce plugin, which I don't do much e-commerce on WordPress. I've heard that as one of the more popular e-commerce plugins. So they found that the site that triggered this alert contained some JavaScript that was loading a favicon file from that malicious domain. So favicon is that little tiny icon that pops up in like your browser tab when you go to a website. In this case, the image itself was a match for the compromised website. Like it was their actual logo of their brand. But they found that inside the favicon's EXIF data, so the metadata in it, under the copyright tag, it actually contained some malicious JavaScript that the website then retrieved and executed. So basically, the attackers were using steganography in this case to hide malicious code, get it onto a site, and then execute it, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, we've seen it before. The favicon thing isn't different, and even EXIF data isn't different, but this was certainly interesting. I will say, yeah, I mean, you explained it pretty well by saying metadata, but if people have not heard of EXIF as a metadata part of images and audio files, EXIF stands for Exchangeable Image File Format, and it has all kinds of extra data. Like if you've used Photoshop, there's a place where you can edit an image and you can put things like your name, your business name, the copyright name. Sometimes your camera will put the actual model of the camera, your lens information for when the picture's taken. For WAV or audio files, you still might have similar data about the creator of the file. So as you were saying, it's metadata, but it's very programmatic. Most users never look at EXIF data or even know it exists, but know that, for instance, every picture you take with your phone is giving a lot of information about you and putting it in that image. You know, things like, even GPS location in some cases to show where you took the picture.
That's gotten people in trouble before too, like journalists and stuff that have taken a picture and it's exposed like the location of whoever the heck they were interviewing.
Of a source, yeah. And it's why there's actually a lot of EXIF cleaners. If you care about anonymity when you're posting to social media, there are cleaners out there. But in this case, it's not the privacy we're concerned about. But if you think about, you know, I've seen web application vulnerabilities exploited this way because this programmatic data is sometimes used by developers in programmatic ways. Like if you upload an image file to some image hosting site, it might want to add information about the image to its database. So it might have some sort of web application code that specifically looks for parts of the EXIF data to pull information out of it. And in this case, you know, it's that's how something like this JavaScript might be run.
Yep. In this case, though, it was kind of smart in how it worked. So like the JavaScript that was on the site itself, it basically just acted as a loader. And in that case, it might not have enough like malicious signatures or red flags to be caught by anti-malware engines that scan JavaScript. And a lot of anti-malware engines might not scan image files. So if it can grab that image file and then yank the JavaScript out of there, it can run it in just a eval statement and run it as if it were that site's code. And that's what it did in this case. It loaded up payment card skimming malware. Interestingly enough, like the data it stole, like the payment card info, it exfiltrated that in an image as well, which is something we've seen a few times too, where it just base64 encodes it. And then I've seen examples where it sends like a GET request to the attacker server with that base64 encoded thing as the image. Obviously, it's not going to load anything, but then they can just check the logs, decode it, and they've got the data. In this case, it was just posting that data back to that malicious server. In fact, posting it back to that favicon file. So all of this whole thing was basically just self-contained in this favicon image, which was kind of interesting. Malwarebytes did actually get a hold of the whole toolkit that the attacker was using. It looks like they slipped up at one point and left a zipped copy of basically all their code on one of the compromised servers. So in their blog post, I'll add it to the show notes, they went through like the script on that creates the favicon file itself, like how it worked. They went through the JavaScript or the PHP script that obfuscated the JavaScript. So they used a specific toolkit for that. It was really interesting stuff in this case. And like you said, like we've seen a few of these things in different types of attacks, but really interesting seeing it all kind of like in this self-contained package for just with favicons as
payment cards. And it's unusual. I mean, when we look at the threat landscape on a large level, a lot of attacks are just basic 101 stuff. So whenever you see something going to this level of evasion, it's always extra interesting.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. I mean, credit card skimming is getting harder and harder because the payment industry is obviously throwing money at security. So they definitely have to get more sophisticated in how they get their skimmers into our networks.
Yep. Towards the end of their post, they even were able to take like different artifacts from the code, domains and who they were registered to, and basically piece together and get a form of attribution for who they think was doing this. And they were able to tie it to a few other mage card skimming attacks as well. So really interesting content from them. Good news is, if you're a DNS Watch customer, all these domains are a part of our block list. So you don't have to worry about them loading up in that case.
I can't tell what tool they used for the, like, you're referring to how they used some of the domains they saw. Like, I think one of the initial domains that's actually pretty common, it wasn't heavily used in this one, but it was part of it, was cddn.site, which is a well-known. But anyways, there's a tool out there called, wow, I had it on my mind and I just lost it. It's essentially a Multigo. It's an open source tool, although there's a commercial version. But you can give it things like some domains or an email address, and it will find other domains that have been related from a threat intelligence standpoint, and other code and other email addresses. So it looks like they did some of that to, as you say, kind of give an idea of the people and domains associated with this threat actor in particular.
There's a lot of data they can use to link different attacks together, like the email address associated with the domain registration, which IPs different domains have been associated with, even what like BGP, autonomous systems, and IP address has been with. And if you look deep enough in a lot of these attacks, you can piece them together and get a decent idea, paired with like code snippets themselves too, and track individual campaigns over time.
And it is getting a little harder because of new services out there that help you anonymize your domain registration information. But sometimes you even can get company names based with whoever registered domains. Although that's getting a little harder. By the way, while we're talking about, you know, some of these, what nerds like us call indicators of compromise, do know that our products like DNS Watch and WebBlocker have a lot of these domains. But if you're just a random listener who doesn't use our products, you should definitely check out Malwarebytes' research. Like many, they list a ton of indicators of compromise. And these are essentially domains you can add to your blacklist if you have any sort of security mechanism that will block them.
Yep. And if you are a DNS Watch customer, we've already blocked them for you. Hooray!
Yeah, don't worry about it. We got you.
We got you. So cool research. Definitely check it out. I'll post a link in the show notes to this. They went through a lot of work, basically showing the attribution and exactly how this all worked. Really cool stuff.
I love when researchers do that.
You and me both. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey is at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you'll hear from us next week.